Hello everyone, this is Nelson for Beta Wave Radio, and today I have with me Sam Barlow of Isle, Silent Hill, Shattered Memories, and the upcoming Her Story, which will be releasing June 24th to give the great detective, Batman, a little bit of a head start.
Yeah, I think Batman comes out on the 23rd, so you know they've got a whole day to be the best detective game out in June before we come and steal that off.
How are you doing today, Sam?
I'm good. It's a sunny day. Game is almost out, so it's just all the small tedious things I have to do now.
After being in the industry for so long, do you still get jitters?
But this is completely different to anything I've done before. In the the last game I actually released was Shattered Memories, and that was 2009-2010, and that was, you know, box product, through a traditional publisher. So
has changed so much since then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I kind of stopped day-to-day working on that game before it was finished, you know, when it got to the kind of final bug testing phase, you know, then I was moved on to other things, pitching for, you know, projects and stuff. So, you know, I was in the position I was in, you always kind of skipped that back end. And then when the game kind of came out, you already kind of, you know, moved on to something else. Whereas with this, not only is it, so it's the first digital thing I've put out, which is kind of cool because you're that much closer to the people actually buying it. You know, I get, you know, pre-orders through straight to me, you know, see people's emails, their names popping up, get to chat to people. And, you know, just cutting out that whole process of having to stick a game in a box, load it up on trucks, drive it all, you know, to the shops and, you know, the whole idea that for a game to work, it had to be something that someone was willing to put on a shelf in a shop. You know, the whole digital thing has completely kind of changed things now so that, you know, you can make something like Her Story, which, you know, has a very particular style to it, has a very particular audience potentially, but, you know, that can still be a sizable audience and I can reach them digitally. So it's a very different experience to me, you know, getting to the back end of a project. And of course, this is the first time I've done something like this on a much smaller scale, you know, doing 99% of the work myself. So I'm having to do all the fun, tedious stuff that I would have given over to other people to do in terms of fixing all the bugs and spinning it to everyone.
Actually, I wanted to go on a little bit of an aside there. You were talking about the process of getting a game into the shop and putting it up on a shelf and the difference between digital. Do you also think that as a creator, there's a little bit of a difficulty there because as an indie product, you can't really separate the thing from yourself. You're doing 99% of the work, but also it's very ephemeral. You can't go to the store and see, okay, there's my work on the shelf. It's just this little page on the wide expanse of the internet.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of different though, right? Because, Shattered Memories is a good case in point in that kind of when that game came out, you know, its existence as a physical product was so dependent on, you know, Konami marketing, convincing people it was going to do well, the big retailers, the kind of GameStops and Best Buys and whatever, believing that there was a market for this game on the Wii at that time and people were kind of backing away from the Wii at that point. So although that was a very real physical product and I could go into shops and make sure I moved it onto the top shelf and it was eye-like, actually, there's only so many copies put out there and, I don't even have a physical copy of that game myself because we only got a few complimentary copies that got shared amongst the team. And because it was a limited run, the price is quite high if I buy it now on eBay or whatever. So, you know, although it was a physical thing, it kind of, you know, is able to vanish and disappear and kind of age. Whereas, at least with the digital stuff, there's a longer shelf life. And just in terms of having people talk about it and engage with it, it's a very different world. So, you know, back in 2009, there were some people who kind of played Shattered Memories and really liked it. Social media wasn't quite... So, you know, now, perhaps if something like Shattered Memories had come out, then you would probably have seen, you know, people being able to spread the word much more. And if it was a digital product, you know, people can read a tweet 1 minute, click a button and kind of go down at the next. So it's much easier for people to kind of take a punt on things. And obviously, very recently with the Steam refund thing, you know, it's even easier now for you to kind of hear about something, download it and take a kind of punt on it, have a go and see if it's something that's interesting.
So games, by their nature, have always been a little bit ephemeral. You spoke before the interview about providing a sense of closure in games, even though your forte seems to be nonlinear narratives. if it was on a pedestal in some museum, you could walk away from it and be like, oh, that was the experience, whereas a game has to provide some sort of closure. So in some sense, because games age, because they are made in limited runs, or they were in the past, they've always been these things that, as sad as it is, eventually disappear and just live on in our memories.
Yeah, I mean, obviously part of that is the kind of onwards momentum of the industry in terms of, you know, the technology, platforms that come and go. I mean, it's something that's really, it's a very hard and weird thing to talk about when you're creating things. And, you know, I have friends that are film writers, are novelists, and it's something that everyone discusses because, you know, when you're choosing what is your medium, what are you going to tell your stories in? There's obviously whatever you're drawn to is a big factor, but at the same time, there's kind of the cold, hard reality where you sit down and go, well, how many people can I actually reach with this? Let's say I go and write a novel, and it's well received, you know, how many thousands of people are actually going to go out and read this in hardcover versus putting up a free Twine game on the internet? Potentially, you've actually got a kind of much larger audience there. And then although video games do have this kind of horrendous shelf life, I think there's a kind of romantic notion that things like books, paintings, big works of sculpture are timeless and that, you know, they never disappear. But actually, in reality, you know, rewind 50 years, rewind 100 years, the books people were reading then, the books that people thought would be the timeless classics, many of them are out of print, some of them you've never heard of. You know, there is this, you know, force of work which is generally consigning works of art to the kind of rubbish heap anyway. Whether or not there's a problem with running it on the hardware or whether it's been kind of technically sort of outdated. So
I think we're sort of seeing that thing with Fallout. Fallout 4 was just announced and they had a giant sale on the Fallout games and people would download it, and because of certain difficulties with games for Windows Live, which it originally launched with, and etc., a lot of people couldn't physically run it on their machines anymore.
Yeah, I mean that unique combination of kind of hardware and actual software makes things so tricky. I mean, even, you know, playing old PC games, running them from DOSBox and things like that, you know, is an art form. and, you know, something like, you know, so, you know, probably the best thing I put out was Shattered Memories, but, you know, that requires you to have a Wiimote, have, you know, a Wii or a Wii U, and, you know, as much as you can emulate it, those are very unique pieces of hardware that might not exist, you know, 5-10 years in the future.
Oh, so when you're talking about a game like, say, Splatoon, and it harnesses the Wii U's features specifically years down the road, how easy or how difficult will it be to actually experience that again?
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you get into gaming?
It was kind of a weird bouncing around. So, you know, I grew up playing a lot of games. When I was a kid, we had an Amstrad CPC, which was kind of like the kind of home computers in the UK. There was the Spectrum, the Z80, and there was the Commodore 64, and the third one was the Amstrad CPC, and that was kind of awkward in the middle one. It wasn't as cool as the Commodore 64. It wasn't as cheap as the Spectrum. It was kind of an awkward one, but it had all the same games and was pretty cool. So I used to play a lot of that. Loved playing some of the kind of original text adventures and stuff like that, which, you know,
they very much relied on that possibility space.
Yeah, they often had kind of subject matter that felt more grown up and interesting. So, you know, when I was young, one of my favorites was a game called Corruption by Magnetic Scrolls, which was about insider trading in London. And, you know, your character got to go to a secret casino and get drunk. And, you know, his wife was trying to get him killed, I think, behind his back with his business partner. It was all this kind of stuff. But I never really thought about going into games myself. I mean, you know, I would, as most kids did then, I could program BASIC and stuff, and, you know, me and my friends would make our own games between each other, you know, swap them on floppy disks. Most of these were kind of offensive text adventures that were usually full of in-jokes, and you would write these text adventures where you'd play as one of my friends, and the whole exercise would be kind of forcing them to do humiliating acts and just rip the piss out of them. So I was doing that, and, you know, I even had one of my birthday presents was the Maxam compiler, which was like a machine code compiler allowing you to try and, you know, make your own games. And, you know, so I was doing all this kind of stuff, but just never, I guess I didn't even really think, where do games come from? It was like, you know, games exist and you buy them on the shelf and they're made in this magical kind of place where games get made.
Sort of like the Black Room and White Room and Twin Peaks. It's just something out there.
And I imagine, I mean, we had a couple of kind of, you know, rock star programmers and stuff back in the day then, but you know, it wasn't the kind of thing that was kind of talked about in terms of, you know, it wasn't as much focus on the process of the people making the games. I was kind of brought up, you know, my dad was like the first in his family to go to university. And so, you know, I was brought up in that kind of atmosphere very much. You go to university to get a kind of degree, and then you can get a really good, well-paid job, and that kind of aspirational kind of thing. So very much when I was thinking about what job will I do, it was very much kind of instilled in me that you go and get a proper degree at university, and then you can get a job where you do something sensible. I had lots of, you know, kind of artistic interests, but it was very much, you know, that was the thing I'd do as a hobby. Yeah, you can always do painting and writing and stuff. That can always be a fun little thing you do. So I went to university and did. I started off doing physics, and then I found that involved far too much sitting in laboratories, twiddling oscilloscopes. I transferred to maths, which was relatively speaking more interesting. And then kind of left university not really knowing where I was, you know, what I was going to do. I mean, at the time, this is when I wrote Isle when I was at university. So, you know, I was doing this stuff and engaging with, like, the community online who were making these kind of text games. Again, all the people doing that were kind of doing it knowing that there was no commercial future, or at least thinking there was no commercial future in interactive fiction and stuff like that back then. And I got a job working over in the States. So I moved to DC where I was working for a software company doing business intelligence software, which was slightly more interesting than that sounds. We had kind of a CEO who was wanted to be a kind of futurist and was always doing speeches about putting chips inside your head and all that kind of fun stuff. And that kind of worked out for a while, and then there was the dot-com crash, and at some point I got made redundant, came back to the UK. And it was kind of hard to get a job continuing that because I was very much categorized as being part of a dot-com thing and all the other dot-com companies were going bust at the same time. And I had a friend who actually was a coder at a games company at that point, and he knew that I did lots of artwork and he suggested I get a job as an artist for a video games company. So I sent I kind of created this little portfolio, which luckily no longer exists anywhere on the internet, hopefully, because it was awful. And so it's the kind of thing where if someone sent it to me, I'd just laugh. And I sent that to, I think, every video games company in the UK. And I heard back from two. And one of those, Climax, I went and got a job there. And we worked on Serious Sam for the GameCube. So I was there initially as a kind of artist / level designer and very rapidly moved over to the design team. And then after that, kind of very rapidly kind of moved to become a kind of lead designer. I think mainly because I just wouldn't shut up. I think it's a very interesting aspect of making games because games they don't really have that single act of creation. And I think they could, and maybe it would help if they did, but the length of time it takes to make a game, the number of people involved kind of fights against it. Even with, you know, with movies, there is a screenplay. And although the trend now is you have lots of writers, still the kind of pure idea there is that a screenwriter goes away and spends 6 months writing this, and although there's outside feedback and stuff, there's a focus on creating that screenplay. And as much as it might then change when you go and shoot the film and then edit it,
that's the original vision for the film.
It's on a concrete thing, and there's a lot of focus on creating and sculpting this thing in that state. And I think with games, the real challenging aspect of games is that and partly this is an aspect of how games are made commercially. Certainly in my experience, a lot of times games will get signed off of small demos or ideas or pitch concepts which are, you know, fairly high level. And then once the game's signed, because, you know, a big game takes, let's say, it takes 3-4 years to make.
Yeah.
And there's a huge amount of money being put into it. No one wants to take another year. No one wants that to take 5 years or 6 years. So you could in theory have a period up front where a small team or an individual is thinking deeply about what the game is going to be and crafting some kind of blueprint. Generally what happens is you start moving and you're kind of laying the tracks as you're kind of thinking about the game. And there might be quite a kind of important short-term objective, like the kind of initial vertical slice or proof of concept demo, which might require quite a lot of effort to create something that looks polished in a small amount of time. So once a kind of large-scale game kicks off, there is a huge amount of people involved. So there is a certain type of person who maybe can still try and have that level of creative focus whilst managing all these people. So I think that kind of narrows the types of personality that can sort of succeed as the kind of creative head of a video game, because you are trying to combine the kind of aspects of being like, you know, a film director, of managing something on that scale, you know, of running such a large team, with the kind of the creative aspects of actually trying to create a whole new world storyline or kind of gameplay concept.
And it's often seen as at odds with game narrative, because when you're laying down the track as you're moving and you're trying to get the game done and polish up the gameplay mechanics, and etc., a lot of times writers attest to sections of the story being cut, having to find, okay, how much can we feasibly drop from the story while making sure it's still strong?
Yeah, and you know, like I say, I think there is an argument that you could eliminate some of that by having a much bigger upfront concentration on creating, authoring what that experience is going to be. And I think people like to kind of talk about the idea that in video games, because so much of it is about the player experience, a lot of times you won't know these things until you've actually built it. But I think sometimes that is just a convenient way of kind of not going down that road and just getting on with stuff. Because I think there is a lot to be said for kind of upfront thinking about these things. I mean, you know, I've pushed back in the past with publishers where, you know, they said, can we have the finished script here, then we'll build the game here and stuff. And it's like, it makes far more sense to actually say, we're going to have this outline of things here, and we'll push back finalizing some of these story elements till here. And, you know, just giving that process of creating the narrative and the gameplay, making sure they're meshed, making sure that that's given the right amount of room before that all gets kind of locked down, because it becomes very brittle once things are locked down. You know, like you say, once something's locked down, then trying to cut a level or lose a game mechanic or something becomes much, much more difficult.
Do you think that not immediately entering the game industry has actually affected the way you develop games? Because when you look at something like Silent Hill Shattered Memories, that's a survival horror game where you actually can't fight back. In Isle, which is the game you designed in university, you have a single move to direct the main character and advance the plot, and it's very non-linear. The more you type and the more you direct the story, the more you learn about the world you are placed in. Those games are both very much outside of the traditional canon of game development and design. So do you think not immediately coming in saying, I want to be a game developer, learning the so-called best practices, has actually led you down the road you're on today, leading up to your new game, Her Story?
That could be some truth in that. I mean, I think I've always had a very wide range of interests, and I get most excited by stuff that is a little bit different, or by, I mean, for me, a lot of times the seed of an idea is usually something that's quite structural. So it might be in Isle, say, going, well, this is a game with only a single move. What does that mean for the game?
Sort of like Ludum Dare.
Yeah, I guess, you know, you have these, I guess maybe the difference there is a lot of times the kind of, for game jams, you're coming up with a theme which gives you this whole wide range of kind of cool stuff or interesting things that people could riff off. And usually these are kind of, by the time an idea comes to me, it's usually something that my subconscious has worked over for a long time. And then, so it'll pop into my head and I'll think, that's kind of a cool idea. And then I'll be like, oh, actually, there's all this stuff my brain has been kind of beavering away with. And it'll often be several things kind of coming together at once. So, you know, with Her Story, I've always wanted to make a kind of police procedural game. You know, I've pitched several times things in that kind of thematic area. And it's really frustrating with traditional publishers, because you look at it and you go, look at any kind of TV station, you know, they will have a couple of police shows. This is kind of a core part of the entertainment world. You look
it's
at
one of
the,
those evergreen franchises or evergreen concepts.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the detective novel, the police procedural, the kind of crime thriller, these are, you know, cornerstones of all other entertainment media. But with video games, they've never really kind of caught on, and there are kind of isolated examples.
Do you think that has to do with immediacy? Because you go back to one of your first projects was Serious Sam, where it's very immediate. Things run at you and try to shoot them as fast as possible, where when you're dealing with something that's a detective, like true detective work, even in the Batman games, most of the action is not focused on the detecting, but the punching, because games are very much immediate. Well, they're thought of as a very immediate medium.
I mean, you have a lot of detective games that are essentially a detective skinning on top of traditional game genres. Like, say, the kind of detective work you'll see in something like Batman is very loose and kind of fairly simple. I think the big problem seems to be that the core of the reason why police stuff and detective stuff is so popular is it's dealing mainly with people, realistic people in a kind of recognizable world. And, you know, a lot of the drama comes from human interaction, human stories. There is a lot of, you know, detective stories are kind of interesting to me because they're quite sophisticated narratives. You know, it might be kind of primetime entertainment, but it's usually several layers to a detective story. You have the kind of the story of the detective himself, then you have the story of the crime, so you've got different time periods, you've got the order in which clues are discovered, you usually have characters who are lying, concealing, so there's a lot of subtext in there. So they're very, you know, complex pieces of storytelling. And
trying to capture as much nuance as you can within a digital realm, one where you're just interacting with pixels on a screen with a mouse or a controller.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that video games struggle with is presenting nuanced characters, nuanced character behavior, you know, whether that's actually just in the mechanics or in just rendering.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's expensive. One of the things that kind of sparked her story was it was at the start of 2014. I was doing a talk at the Glasgow Film Festival, and there was Ragnar and Rihanna Pratchett were on the panel, Ragnar Tornquist, and we were talking about it, and we were saying there's this kind of horrible, it's not quite an irony, I guess, but if you look at something like film, and you look at, say, horror films, right, which are, you know, very low budget, potentially experimental part of film, and it works because one of the cheapest things you can do is just take a camera and a couple of actors and film them and have those actors expressing. And if you have a good script and you have a good performance, that really works and it can be very moving and it can touch people. But in video games, having that realistic character performance on screen is one of the more expensive things. You're talking about now you're into kind of expensive motion capture and you're pushing the budget up. So to actually try and make something that's true to that kind of low budget filmmaking in a traditional video game, you're actually making something very expensive. So, you know, the games that have the high-end performance capture are usually the big blockbuster titles. So, you know, there's always been that problem. And there was, speaking to publishers, you always get this kind of weird response, which I've had from a few people in her story as well, where they go, well, I get the crime stories, detective stories, police procedurals are big business elsewhere, but that's fine, that's covered. You know, TV's got that covered. We don't need to touch that for video games because no one's going to come to video games for this stuff. They'll go and get it on TV and things, which I think is an acknowledgement of potentially how difficult it might be to do something in that space.
So everybody told you it was impossible, and you did it anyway.
Yeah, so I've always wanted to go and do that, and obviously working within a traditional model, that never got any traction. So when I decided that I would try making something independent, that was definitely a part of it, was thinking, well, this is something I've wanted to do for a while. I've always been interested specifically in that interrogation room. Like I grew up as a huge fan of the show Homicide: Life on the Street, where, you know, some of the best scenes in that series were just the detectives in the interrogation room. And, you know, there's incredibly dramatic interrogations. There's one episode of that series which is just an entire episode set inside the interrogation room. You know, it's just really compelling television. And like I said, I kind of got this background in being really interested in text games, interactive fiction, and have quite a lot of affection for the actual kind of text parser, right, of games where you type in words to do stuff. But also acknowledge that has never really worked perfectly. And I think if you grew up on text games and you learned the kind of the rules that govern how those games work, you can play those games.
Didn't know those rules, it made it a very labyrinthian practice to try to be like, go west. I don't understand go. Move west.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that illusion of, wow, I'm actually communicating in natural English is shattered very quickly, and it can become quite frustrating.
And is that why, going back to Isle, why with your first thing you decided to make it to where so many options are available or so many ways to accomplish the same thing and type in various inputs? Because even when I played it, this is a game made back in the 90s, and there were very few words it didn't quote-unquote understand. I wasn't in a situation where that immersion was broken.
that was definitely part of the appeal, I think, was, you know, lots of people were looking for kind of systemic ways how to improve the quality of what the game understands. And I've always been attracted to just brute force solutions. So, you know, with that one, it's like, okay, I will just try and cover everything you could possibly do in the situation because I've only got one move. You know, in another game, this would never work. But yeah, that was definitely attractive.
And can you describe Isle as you're talking about this for those who aren't familiar with it?
So Isle is a game that I made in, I think it came out in 1999. And it's a very simple premise. The game opens with a character who stood in the pasta aisle of a supermarket. And
were you eating pasta at the time? Was that the inspiration?
No, but I think I was thinking about holidays in Rome and around, and I was trying to think of a very mundane situation. So, you know, partly that game, although when I finish the game, it's usually the characters and the story that mean the most to me. Again, when I started that game, one of the seeds there was I was very frustrated with, at that time, the people making interactive fiction were doing really interesting work. I mean, there was a lot of exploration of different types of narrative, different narrative tricks, some really clever things, people coming to that medium and making it a personal artistic medium in ways that people hadn't before. And so it was really, as someone that kind of wanted to see video games become an interesting medium, it was fascinating. But at the same time, everyone was still kind of tied to the nostalgia for the traditional text adventures, which we'd all kind of grown up on, and that was why we're here. But it meant that you had to do things like, you know, you could be playing the most ambitious text adventure, you know, real kind of Ingmar Bergman stuff, and the person writing it would still have to cater for silly commands, right? So there's a tradition in text adventures where if you type XYZZY, you'll get a funny message. And this is like a callback to the original Zork. And every game you made had to do that because the first thing people would do when they were playing your game was type that in and see what funny thing you'd done. And if you hadn't done that, they kind of felt like, oh, this guy's not trying. And you know, and that would count for...
It goes back to the thing for even graphic adventures where you think it's really simple until you realize you have to write a message for if someone tries to pull an object, or if they push it, or if they look at it, or if they use it and there's nothing in their hand, or if they use it with the wrong object, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and on and on and on.
Yeah, it's in it, and generally the response would be humor, right? So, you know, I can... You know, I'm playing a traditional text adventure. I can kill things, right? So I could type kill, and I could... deliberately do this in an amusing way. So, you know, you meet the character who is, you know, the friend of the hero in a traditional game, and you can type kill father or kill king or whatever. And clearly this doesn't exist in the possibilities of this story. It makes no sense. But to show that the game is listening to what you're saying, you would get a funny response. So, you know, you'd get some joke about maybe not now, maybe tomorrow after they've washed the dishes. I mean, it'd be some silly throwaway comment.
And do you think that partially as people saw those messages, that is part of what helped break the immersion? Because once they tried it once, they had to try it on everything, and then they would inevitably hit something where it didn't get that response. The I don't understand what you're saying, and then you're taken out of the experience.
Well, I mean, the issue for me was that as a kind of community of people that played those games, not only did you kind of expect those responses, but it became part of the experience for you. So, like I say, you could be playing a very serious work, and even as a player, so I'd be frustrated with myself, because even as someone playing these games, I would step outside the character and type in dumb things. I would kind of, you know, it's the equivalent of, in an FPS, trying to shoot your friends, trying to smash stuff up in the middle of a very important cutscene in Half-Life, whatever. And this was very frustrating to me. So a big... idea behind Isle was, I'm going to make a game where if the player starts doing this dumb stuff, the game will run with it and actually give them the story they deserve, right? So if I start...
I love how you say the story they deserve.
Yeah, it was kind of slightly aggressive, but it was like, I want to make the player feel guilty. I want to punish the player for them typing this dumb stuff, right? So if they start trying to kill the woman they see in the pasta ride, if they start climbing the shelves, throwing stuff around, doing these kind of destructive, silly actions that we naturally do in games, then I want to give them the story of that guy. So, you know, like I say, a lot of the kind of outcomes in that story describe someone who has problems. And then there's kind of a movement as you're playing the game, you realize this, and you then start actually trying to seek the actions that will give you a normal story, that will actually give you a character who has a happy ending. And
it's reverse psychology.
Yeah, and so that for me was a very interesting thing. That was a big part of Isle. So I wanted to create this situation where, like I was saying, it's a supermarket aisle. It's the most mundane experience, and we've all had it. We all go shopping. We all go to supermarkets. So by placing you in that experience, it's kind of making you question those actions, because if I'm in a fantasy castle and there's a goblin, it's fine if I want to kill him or throw the fireball at him or set fire to the car. You know, these silly things are a little bit more permissible because I'm in this fantasy world and I'm acting out. But if I'm dumping you in a supermarket and saying you're just someone in a supermarket and this is the real world, then it kind of makes you think about those things and kind of turns things on their head. So, yeah, again, that was very much the seed of that game for me. And then as I started writing it, this progression from the types of stories that Isle was about, and like I say, the kind of, you know, although the game resets every time you do a move, there's a kind of progression in there for the player, which is slowly seeking out these happier endings potentially, or just trying to kind of create a more nuanced understanding of the different stories that are there.
Which is made more difficult when, as you said, the progression of the player isn't quantifiable. It isn't just numbers ticking up on an XP bar. And whenever you step outside of the quantifiable, that's both really exciting territory and really difficult to do. So you go from Isle to, you could say it's a more systems-driven game, Silent Hill, Shattered Memories, to finally, today, we have her story, and all these years have progressed, all of these things have happened in the industry, and it's almost like coming back to that indie thing. You're working by yourself, you're again making this story, and you're again exciting that part of your players' brains that wants to not know what's going to come next or where their mind is going to take them.
Yeah, I think this, you know, it's one of the most interesting parts of games, right? So I'm really interested in traditional storytelling. So Shattered Memories was a good example, I think, of, it was trying to do something that traditional stories do very well, which is tell a story that has a twist or builds towards a very important climactic moment, which then sends your mind racing back and it pulls everything that's gone before it together and creates this very emotional, moving moment, right? And it's something you can do in film and novels very easily. That was an example of, here's how to do that in a video game, in that a lot of the things we were doing in that game were about pulling the player in, making themselves feel part of it, and actually kind of, without necessarily realizing it themselves, acting out this story themselves, so that when we kind of did this big cathartic moment at the end, it was that much more involving. It was that much more moving for them because they had kind of played a part in it, and the way they had approached the story played into what that big twist was.
And then in her story, you could potentially arrive upon that moment, like right when you start, or a few moves down. It's very much player-directed, and it's entirely dependent upon the person. What could be mundane to one person because of their personal journey through the game could be mind-blowing to someone else.
Yeah, so her story was very much an attempt to go beyond that and actually try and create a narrative that can still provide the kind of callbacks and the things sparking off each other, but give over much more control to the player, so kind of hand them the reins much more. And do that in a way that, I think the thing that people kind of get when they play her story that becomes much clearer to them once, you know, they just play it for a few minutes, is the way it kind of just twists how you experience the story and how you kind of walk through the story, that it's, you know, there's kind of this element of word association to it almost, where you're watching clips and you've got the mental process of trying to place them in your head, paint a picture from these disparate bits of information, and then you're kind of riffing off that yourself to then go and search for things and explore the other clips. And it's, like I say, it's very much a kind of personal thing in that you're now directly kind of exploring the story space.
For those who aren't familiar with your new game, what is Her Story?
So the premise of Her Story is very simple. When you play the game, you are essentially sat in front of a simulation of a old computer interface from the 90s. And this is a police computer.
Complete with a game that they aren't supposed to have in the rubbish bin.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are a few details in there to kind of make it feel authentic. And yeah, this police computer has been pulled out of storage, and it contains a database which has on it hundreds of clips taken from a series of police interviews with a woman about her husband, her missing husband. And this is all real film footage. And the kind of core mechanic of the game, the way you interact, is you type in search words into the database, and then the game will give you all the clips in which the woman uses those words. So, you know, if you search...
Are the length of the clips randomly generated, or did you specifically have to define the length of all those clips depending on what someone searched for?
The way the database works is, contained in the database are all of the woman's answers to questions, and it doesn't have any of the detective's questions in there. They're in a separate database. So For each clip is a succinct answer that will finish when she stops talking and the detective starts talking again. So it's kind of like it's like playing Jeopardy, in that you're often trying to figure out what the question was to which she's giving an answer. So there's lots of different levels of kind of inferring things. So you will search for you'll type in husband, and you'll get back all the clips where she talks about her husband. But, you know, you might discover place names, character names. You might think of verbs, nouns, adjectives. What's wonderful for me about the mechanic is there's the kind of very concrete detective work you're doing, in that you might pick up a character name you'd never heard of and search for that. But then there's a more kind of creative way of playing as well, which is just to kind of think of words that might be used in these kind of contexts. Is think of words that might be thematic, or, you know, that you pick up on it as just part of the way that this woman talks. So although the core interaction is very simple, you are searching for words. There's lots of different kind of layers to it. So it kind of has a feel of being an organic process. You know? And it's a bit like the old Ultima games, some old RPGs, when you had conversations with the characters, rather than selecting from a series of menus, you would type in keywords. And, you know, they were very limited. It was limited to which keywords you could use, but it felt slightly organic. In some ways, her story is my attempt to give you a game with a text interaction that is very rich, and you can type tons of stuff and it will work, but without all those problems of actually pretending it's a real conversation, or it's kind of a real, passing of your English. So it's something that gives you much more freedom as a player. Because I think that, you know, having made a couple of Silent Hill games, I'm very au fait with, you know, telling a story through diary pages and bits and pieces. And a lot of times I create ideas because I get frustrated, but there's a frustration in me that is such a popular way of telling a game.
The whole audio diary situation, where if you want to flesh out a world, people inexplicably record all of their motivations and you find them.
It can work well, it can work badly. But it feels too easy. I think, you know, when we made, say, Silent Hill Origins, we had a very small amount of time to make that game. And to make that easy for ourselves, we said, let's just make a traditional Silent Hill game. And it was really fun because you had all the limitations and you knew exactly what you were doing and the template was there. And, you know, writing those little diary pages is kind of a fun thing. It's like, I'm going to tell a little three-act story in three pages. I'm going to sprinkle them around here. It's very nice. But like I say, it almost feels kind of too easy. And as much as games give you the impression that you're finding these random things and that you're finding them and you're discovering them in an order that's entirely up to you, in 99% of the cases, it's very much, you were led to that note, so... You know, a game like Gone Home, where the idea is that you are just free to explore this house and poke through the doors and discover stuff, still the spine of that story is told through glowing white notes that are kind of put in a very obvious place. And as much as there's a kind of disordered timeline to those notes, that's the order, I imagine, mostly that the design is intended for you to read them. So you get a build-up to a climactic reveal, and, you know, it's very much traditional kind of storytelling. So I wanted to push myself with this to see what would happen if I took away some of that control and gave more of the freedom to the player, made it much, much richer. So, you know, like I say, there are hundreds of clips in this game. The order in which you discover them is going to be very different, but it's not entirely random. You know, if you look at something like Dear Esther, which is a very cool game, they have a random element to some of the story bits that are dropped into that game, to the point where different playthroughs can have slightly kind of contradictory elements. And that works for that game, but here I wanted something that made more sense, that was concrete. And one of the early things I did was actually got hold of a bunch of real police transcripts and kind of ran them through a kind of system like in this game, just to see what would happen. And that was something that really got me excited, because even though no one had written those police transcripts with a kind of game in mind, with the structure in mind, actually just naturally it kind of worked, because there were words that came up and linked things. There were thematic things. Just by searching on the words these characters were using, you were kind of peeling back layers. And it wasn't just simple kind of through lines of facts and figures. There were, like I say, there was the kind of thematic stuff about their lives. And it really pulled together this thing that I love about police interviews, which is that the nearest thing to a police interview is probably going to see a therapist, in that there is a kind of formal setting, but as far as a homicide detective is concerned, he wants you to think you're his best friend, and talk through things and just run off at the mouth. And, you know, the training for detectives is to ask open questions, just let people talk. Everyone wants to talk. Everyone wants to tell their story. And if there's something, if they have a secret, every part of their being wants to reveal that secret, even if they consciously don't. And so whether they're telling it through their words, they're doing it through their facial expressions and stuff. And so as a storyteller, this is a fascinating thing because you are, you know, in some of these cases, people are coming in and sitting down and they are telling their life story to a detective. And so although, I'm, you know, in this game, I'm limiting myself to everything that happens in the interview room, that gives me a large canvas in which to actually explore this person's life.
What is your hope for her story? What do you want the result of this to be? How do you want players to feel afterward? What do you want the reception to be?
I think the thing that would be nice for me is if their experience of the game kind of mirrored my making. And I think when I started very loosely at the start of development and had roughly in my head what this game was going to be, I was very much coming at it from, this is a detective story, so my mind is kind of in the detective's head and I want to solve this crime. And that's kind of the end goal for a lot of detective fiction. You solve the crime, punish the guilty, kind of move on. There's a level of kind of closure to that. And initially I was thinking that maybe the game is slightly more, not scripted, but there is that kind of element of the player uncovering, and at the end, the conclusion is, you know, who did what, and you've solved the crime. As I started working on the game, and I was watching lots of police footage, reading a lot of stuff, my mind shifted very much, partly through the writing process, but just in general, into the person in the scene. So it then became much more about the story of the woman sat in this seat, about her story. And it was very much more about understanding her life and her story. And as I started to move away from this idea of there being a very simple goal, i.e. solving the crime, this idea of actually understanding everything in the woman's life really became the central point of the story. So, as you say, there's an ability in the game. You could essentially bypass everything, chance upon the kind of the solution to this mystery quite rapidly. But actually, the game is more robust than that, because even if you were to solve this one thing, that then raises other questions. And the kind of core question actually at the heart of the game is, how did this happen? Why did this happen? Who is this person? And there's much more to it. There's kind of, you know, far more layers to it. So I think for me, the kind of goal here is that people play the game and listen to this woman's story and they put the pieces together. And because of this way in which they're taking the pieces and forming the picture in their head, ideally, that story becomes much more real to them, becomes much more moving to them. The kind of level of empathy they have towards this character should be much more heightened. So they kind of come away, and, you know, I had some awesome feedback from some of the people that have had review copies now, where they've said that the days after actually stopping playing the game, they're still thinking about it. This stuff is living on in their head. And for me, that is a beautiful thing that I get out of a lot of traditional stories that you don't necessarily from a lot of video games, where the world of a video game is often really alive and wonderful and interactive when you're in it, when you're running around it, when you're exploring the game. But when you've finished it, it kind of feels like you're done, you've moved on. And you know, a lot of video games, you exhaust them, and by the time you've finished with it, the world actually feels a little bit dead. So the idea of trying to create something that has a life to it, that has a level, that, you know, will keep living on in players' minds is awesome. So I guess, you know, that was quite a long-winded answer, but that would be my hope. That you know, people engage with it and they see this character as being somewhat real. Inside their head, this character comes alive and they develop a level of empathy with this character.
With that said, Her Story, it's coming out June 24th. You can get it. It's really great. The magic moment for me was when 30 minutes in, I finally learned the main character's name. My mind blew. 30 minutes. Don't even know what the character's called. And yet, I can't wait to hear more about her story. And I really, really hope that people fall in love with it as much as I did. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Any final words? Any final thoughts?
I just, like I say, looking forward to people getting a hold of the game. You know, I'm hoping to put it out there at a very reasonable price so that people will take a punt and just, you know, try something a bit different, a bit interesting. And I hope that when they play it, yeah, they have a reaction. They kind of find this thing coming alive in their heads and enjoy it.
This has been Sam Barlow and Nelson of Betawave Radio. Well, thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.